Good. So let me thank the organizers for inviting me. It's always nice to get out of Arizona for this time of the year, at least for a day, although it's chilly here, I must say. I'd like to talk more about just a very practical application of many of the things that we've heard. So we're trying to run a biophysics lab, and what I hope to do is take you through all the good things and the pains and the bad things that actually happen while trying to do this. And we'll actually address some of the problems that already have come up in the previous discussion. So this was a lab that was initially funded by the through an IGAD program, and mainly by initiated by Michael Tabor and Ray Goldstein at the time. Actually, they wrote the proposal before I got to Arizona, but the minute I was there, I actually stepped into the program and actually started working and developing experiments in this lab. There are a number of departments involved, mathematics, biochemistry, MCB officially, but just as we saw before, what people were lacking in Phil's class, we see exactly the same thing in this lab course also. Neuroscience was involved, physics and physiology also, and actually the biomedical engineering should be on there as well. So there were a number of departments actually coming together, pretty much because faculty thought that something needed to be done and actually do something interdisciplinary in a lab environment, and not just in a lecture course. And that's pretty much on this slide, and I think you can look at that. And the NSF IGAD program was awarded in 1998, and people started building the lab in 1999. there's a wide spectrum of students that through the years actually came through this lab. From physics, math, applied math, ecology, evolutionary biology, actually, astronomy, and that's pretty much because Arizona has become interested in astrobiology these days, right? And I think that was one of the first students who actually got interested in that. And then you see that for 2003, I didn't list anyone, but there were a number of students that didn't fit on there, and for 2004, I didn't list anybody, and that's because we didn't teach the class anymore. Why is that? Well, when after, let's see, four or five times, Ray and I said, well, you know, it's time for us to do something else, we ran into this big problem where there is no other faculty that actually want to take this over. Even though we had some good ideas and there was still money to develop new experiments in this lab,
for what to do next.
For example, what we thought would be a great thing to do is take some crystallography data, and actually have students play with crystallography data and actually take a crystal structure as well, because there's a diffractometer in one of the departments, for example. but it proved incredibly hard to actually interest faculty for an effort to do actually make this effort in the lab. I must say, I'm not as good as you that I stuck with the course for 8 years. I just said after five times, this is enough. I mean, and the reason it is enough, because a course like that actually takes an enormous amount of time, we found out. What were the goals of the course? It was pretty much to give students a real life experience of what it actually means to take data. And why not to trust data that you see in a paper, right? And that at least was the feeling that I had when I actually stepped into this course. And I thought that was, to me, one of the most important things. Particularly because I was working with an applied math student at the time who wanted to look at some Keynesian stepping data. And he took just everything as if it were the truth, right? This is like some people read the Bible these days. That worried me a lot. And actually, we did a number of experiments that actually tried to point to certain issues. With respect to that. The initial idea was to actually have students rotate in one semester through about three or four experimental modules. And these modules were in electrophysiology, something with single molecules and optical traps, some pattern formation modules, and some bacterial swimming, which is closely related to many of these. And immediately in the first try, you find out that doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, you know, as I said, we wanted to expose these students to all the experiences that you have when you actually try to set up these experiments. That means that they need to develop laboratorial skills,
right,
which you tend to forget that you just, you know, got that over a long time, and now you're trying to expose these students all at once to do this, right? And you actually figure out that, man, I'm actually really good at this, and you don't realize it anymore. but the students need time to develop those skills. And I think some of the experiments that we did, and we'll see some of the experiments, were a little bit too ambitious in that sense. And that's why that didn't work. And in the end, the students actually ended up working pretty much on the schedule where they did one, or say 1.5, projects in one semester. And we typically start a semester just by trying to get people up to speed, talking about some theoretical backgrounds, about the theory of data acquisition, and topics like that. We also found that that is highly ineffective, because everything you told them here, you actually have to apply it over here. It seems as if you never thought about it for many students. So that's, I think, a typical problem that we see with lecture courses all over, of course. And in the end, we end with student presentations, because we still believe that students don't talk enough in general. And they cannot talk enough, in my opinion. This setup, there were lectures. There were two afternoons of lab work, so 4 hours per afternoon, so it's 9 hours, plus 1 hour of discussion session on Friday, so it was 10 hours altogether. That's why it's hard to get faculty for this, because you're spending 10 hours a week in that lab, if you're in. Students seemed to like it because there was some homework, but it was, you know, limited, so mainly some reading. So that wasn't too much of an issue, although for many students it actually was, for some of the students it was actually difficult to fit it into their schedule, depending on where they were in their grade program. Yes?
Were they graded only on their presentations, or
there was a notebook? They write a report and they do a presentation, and we were around pretty much most of the time, which means that it's very easy to actually, because students form groups, right? And the problem with groups is there's always a student who's going to sort of sit back and just look and watch, right? And you have to keep an eye out and try to pick out that student and have a nice private talk with the student to actually make sure they actually get involved. But the grading was somewhat subjective, so there were no tests or anything in that case. I mean. So what lab did we actually have? The physical layout of the lab. There was quite a bit of money, about 250K for capital equipment, and a lot of money for renovation of the lab. And we actually ended up with 4 setups, all based on 4 optical tables, pretty much. All put in one room, with some benches on each of the sides where you can actually do your wet work, or you can analyze your data using computers. This table is on wheels. You can move this back, and you have a presentation room with a screen and a projector over here, so you can actually discuss experiments right away. The nice thing is that each experiment is actually hooked up to the projector. That means that if one of the students sees something really cool, you flip a switch, it's on the screen, and the entire class can actually see it. That turned out to be a great thing. It also turned out to be a distracting thing, because if something interesting was seen, everything else stopped and students were just chatting and talking for an hour about that experiment. Now you could say that's a disadvantage. I think at some point that's also actually an advantage and actually gives students more breath of what they're actually looking at.
Particularly because
we couldn't let them go through these 3 or 4 units. But. So here's a real picture. It's a horrible old picture, but pretty much what you see, the same setup with the instruments set up on each of the table. Here is the screen that actually comes down. Here's the monitor, and then students squeeze right here behind the table if we want to discuss something. And typically we have 8 to 12 students in a class like that. That's about what would fit. We want to go beyond 12, it becomes difficult. It can be done, but it becomes difficult. We did it once, and it was a little bit tricky. Some of the topics that we actually talk about or we do experiments, right, they're listed here. I won't go through all of them. I will address some of them and actually talk about some of the problems and some of the advantages of doing certain experiments rather than others. but it's focused on actually doing the experiment and actually trying to get some quantitative data out of here, out of that, and actually do an analysis and analyze that and actually see how does it work with what you think is going to happen, the usual thing when you deal with data. Everything started with a warm-up exercise where we just did something really simple, right? We just throw balls. This is almost freshman physics, right? You throw balls into a viscous medium and record velocities. And initially we didn't do this. And then later on actually we found this was actually a good exercise to do, just to make students aware of certain problems, and especially if you give them really narrow cylinders and balls that, you know, you actually see that you're going to divert from this law, of course, and you want to have them think about those problems. Doesn't go according to your model. One problem, a nice experimental problem, is we gave them balls that actually would not break the surface tension, would just lay on there. Right? Certain students get really quickly, go choop, and it just goes. Other students watch this for a while, and then start worrying, and they come and ask you, and you're like, well, why not just choop? So it's actually worked out quite nice. We tried to cover some different length scales, and that was also based on the experience of the faculty involved, of course, with some single molecule experiments on the top, some neurophysiology, this is a ray swimming bacteria, but it always looks like one of these pictures. If you cross your eyes, you should be able to see a 3D picture. Some like the Zabotinsky reaction over here, although I think this is dicastelium, if I'm not mistaken. So swimming of bacteria is always interesting to students, and we found out they love it. They're very surprised if they see them swim, that they actually really swim, but that you also, if you look at the swimming behavior, that it tends to look like a random walk. And they're somewhat surprised by that, although the scales are somewhat different than, you know, a random walk of a small polystyrene particle in fluid. So we have them analyze some of this swimming of bacteria. And Ray, of course, got interested, because I got this slide from Ray, got interested in this because Ray is interested, as you might know, right, in the change from the anodeness of the flagellum, the flagellum here, right? And they looked at that. And then one student came up and said, hey, you know, you see this in plants as well, right, in vines. And actually that led to an independent research project, Ray and Alan Gorielli, actually in applied math, to actually do some experiments with this plant. So actually this was interesting, that student brought in this plant and said, look, it happens here as well, and it actually resulted into, actually it's been published now at this point, a paper.
Those remember phone cards.
Oh, they do. Yeah. The phone cord in my office still does it, yeah. But, and bacterial swimming and bioconvection was something that that was an interesting experiment to do as well. Like, this experiment was nice to do because students could see something and could actually detect something and see patterns. Actually getting to the analysis turned out to be somewhat difficult for the students in this case. And this is one of the problems I think we saw with this particular project, is that it made a very nice experiment. There were nice and interesting things to see. It raised questions. But within the time frame of the entire course, the student kind of got stuck at that point. It was a little bit done, but not too much. There was one of the problems. I think that can be improved, but it needs a slightly different design of actually how you do these types of experiments. This was the experiment that is one of the really cool experiments. Most students think this is a terrific experiment. You don't get to the analysis of the data at all. That's a big problem, as far as I'm concerned. So here what you do is you actually start with the muff, the Manduca sexta, and you're actually gonna, the students actually go in and dissect out the neuron, right? That's okay. They, after you know, a few days in the lab, they actually get that. But then they need to actually start the physiology and start to record from that. That turned out to be incredibly difficult. So that experiment, if we're going to do the lab again, and we hope to do that in the future, is probably not going to be repeated, just for that reason. We might repeat in the sense that actually we will dissect out the neuron beforehand, and the students immediately can get to doing the electrophysiology, which will take out quite a number of days for them to actually really capture data. Some students actually do get data, so it's not hopeless. It's a setup. It's not hopeless, they actually do get data, and then with those students, we actually set up. Talk a little bit about what is in these spikes, right? What can you learn about possible timing in these spikes? And questions like that. You can talk about the Huxley model, right, for how do you get action potential. So then you can actually take it somewhere. But it has been proven very difficult.
Have you ever tried to integrate computer simulations and things like that?
Yes, yeah, we did that at one point. So we tried that, I think, on the third time we did the lab where we said, well, let's just take some computer simulations. Immediately, so you see the students struggling with that, and then we're actually trying to get the dissections and things done. And they say, oh, well, you didn't really get it. Here's a computer simulation. It's a turnoff to most of the students, actually. So if you do that, I think it might be a good idea to start with that. And actually, don't let them see this. They cannot be disappointed. But for the students we work with, that was somewhat of a turnoff. They say, oh, God, you know, we didn't get data, so now we're going to do a simulation, right? So yeah, I think you can do it, but you have to be careful of how you actually do that and not bring it in as a makeup for the fact that you didn't get the experiment. So I'm just going to be brutally honest, as I said in this talk, right? I'm just going to tell you all the things that fail. That doesn't mean that the course failed. There are many, many good things that happened. But I think we're going to learn the most about the things that really didn't work, right? So I came in and I worked on kinesin at that time for a while. I said, oh, I'm going to do a kinesin assay, single molecule assay. What the students are going to do is just going to record velocities of kinesin beads, coated beads, and they're actually going to look at mean velocities, and they're going to look at the variance between those, right, and the randomness, as we called it at the time, right, and to actually couple that back to the underlying biochemical cycle, about the number of rate-limiting transitions when you look at velocities and questions like that, right. Also here, actually getting the students up to speed and using the instrument was actually rather easy. That wasn't too much of a problem. The difficulty was actually getting the students to actually generate the single molecule bead assays. And because that, you know, involves some pipetting. This course of students, you see, there were applied math physics students and things like that. The students who come in, they pick up this thing and say, what the hell is this? You can push on this. Right? Some of the students, it's really a problem, have not seen a pipette ever. And you just, the first time, you don't realize that. And that's something you actually have to deal with. So later on, actually, what we did is I actually prepared some of the samples almost before, and all they had to do was do one incubation step and actually get some velocity data out of that. So then they got data. They need to actually see, how do you analyze this data? Well, this is beads moving across the screen. How do you actually get positions from that? So you need to talk about video particle tracking, how you're going to do that, what is autocorrelation methods that you can use. Yes?
Did the students then do the bead
attachments? The students did the bead attachments, yes. Yeah. So I could prepare it up to the point where everything is ready and all they have to do is mix it, the beads and the kinesis. But they polymerized microtubules also. So they actually looked at the microtubules. And some of them are fluctuating, and the fun thing with that is students immediately ask, hey, why are this, these are fluctuating, right? And but they're still pretty straight, so it gives you a lot of opportunity to about issues like persistence lengths and polymer physics and things like that. So you actually got some video data out of that, and students actually tracked it. Now the particle tracking, initially when I stepped in, the faculty at that point had the idea that the students were just going to write a program to do it. I thought that was ridiculous, because that's not as easy as you think it is. We went with a commercial tracking program. That actually was a good decision, I think, because that actually speeded that up. And there are enough artifacts that you can create within the commercial product to actually make them aware that you have to be really careful of how you actually do this. So that's the good thing. I love data acquisition, so I said, oh, well, we're also going to use an optical trap, right? You're going to trap this bead, right? So you need to learn how to characterize an optical trap. Right? So you ask students how you're going to do that. You brainstorm about that. We don't tell them this beforehand. There's no little lab manual that says, you have to do this and this and this and this and this. But you're going to sit down and say, well, how would you do that? Right? Well, some students use equipartition. Now, that's physics students usually. Even though, you know, the biochem students have to think after a while, so, but wait a second, we've seen that in freshman physics sometimes, and we thought, what the hell is that good for? You know, you never use that. But actually, it turns out to be useful. And you run into a terrific example of that you have to be really careful of how you take your data. Most people will just look at this with a video camera, right? And start looking at the mean square displacement of a bead in an optical thread, right? If you're not careful, the little video camera has a shutter, right, that you can set to 1/10,000th of a second or over 1/50th of a second. The many cameras actually don't allow you to do that, right? So I tell the students, here, why don't you determine the stiffness of the optical trap and turn up the lamp power of the microscope as much as you can? So it actually is a very bright image, and they're going to determine the stiffness. I said, now let's dim the light. Let's determine the stiffness of the optical trap again. You get a completely different answer, because the camera is scaling, right, and it's adjusting its shutter time. I do this each and every time, and I use an example of the student. So how, you didn't change anything on the camera, right? You didn't touch anything. Why does this number change? So you actually have to make them think about, well, when you use a piece of equipment, it's more than just pressing a button, right, and you get an answer. It actually pays to be aware, at least to some degree, right, of how the instrument they actually use actually takes the data and actually deals with the signals. Right. actually, the interesting thing is there are many papers out there, I think, that the people actually don't realize that this actually might happen with a CCD camera in the literature. But, so then we start talking with Kanishin, and at one point, we had a class and everything was somewhat late and didn't really work out. We didn't get to the Kanishin work. I said, well, just to talk about the topic that we were discussing was variance analysis and this randomness parameter, right? And we said, well, what can we actually do without working with Kanishin? Why don't we just take an optical trap, or two optical traps, put them close together, right? And we're actually going to look at the escape of the particle over the energy barrier, right? And I thought that I wasn't too happy with this when I had to do it. Actually, it turns out the students love this. They think it's great. One student walked up to me and said, you know, I never understood kinetics, but I understand kinetics a lot better, actually, right now. so what you do is, indeed, you put two traps together. The bead is jumping back and forth, right? You record the signal. you make histograms. The cool thing, of course, if you know the histogram of the positional data, you can very simply calculate what the potential is going to be. Right? You do that, you determine the curvatures, local curvatures here, you take Carman's theory, you should actually be able to predict what the transition rates are, right? Well, the transition rates you also measure directly here, and that better be consistent, right? So it's a terrific experiment to actually get students involved in looking actually at kinetics. And how does it actually fit in with randomness? Well, if you look at the distribution of times for escape or residence times within one trap, right, it's typically a single exponential with a certain variance, right? However, if you then tell someone, well, let's what would happen actually if you look at the time for the B to actually come to B and actually come back to A, right? Now you got pretty much, because the barrier is approximately equal in height, right, you got two rate limiting transitions there, and your variance should actually be reduced compared to the escape over only one, right? Students check that, they don't believe that at first, particularly, you know, you tell them, well, calculate it. And they calculate and say, yeah, you know, it's right, but it intuitively it doesn't make sense to them. But they measure it, and they're immediately convinced that it actually is indeed the case. The next thing that we actually want to do, because this is, all, of course, at equilibrium, the next thing we'd like to do is actually modulate these barriers, right, and actually, but that needs a little bit of construction in the experiment to actually see things like, well, we can argue it's stochastic resonance or not, but processes like that. This worked actually really well. Yes, I'm almost finished. So this actually worked really well, and this was an experiment where we really got from taking data, calibrating optical traps, being aware of how you acquire the data, sampling rates, all the issues, to actually getting to modeling the data and actually see if it fit with current theory that is out there, right? What disappoints me tremendously in that is that I don't see any biology directly in here, right? So we pay the price for actually doing that. Nevertheless, we've run it now about three times, and to me it looks like it's one of the projects students learn the most about. Yeah.
I would say that you don't see any biology, but this is exactly the kind of
Absolutely.
No, I think physics students need to be applicable, just like biology, yeah. Maybe a different sort of math.
Oh yeah, no, it's, you know, I'm slightly disappointed in that. And it's not that I'm going to discount this experiment and throw it out because it doesn't, you know.
So maybe probably you have to be looking towards different types of physics,
yeah,
in the preparation of the physics students that will come.
Yeah.
There's a lot of chemistry
and biochem in there, and that's why, you know, biochemistry students go like, yeah, we learn about kinetics, but they see it, right? And they really don't know what it means to have an energy barrier. They just like, oh, it's an energy barrier, yeah. But you really see what an energy barrier does, right? Because you crank up the power of the optical trap, the barrier gets higher, and nothing happens, right? It's actually a terrific experiment to actually explore these issues. Let's see. I actually talked about a lot of the problems and things that we learned in here already, so I won't spend too much time on that. Actually, you need some, if you set up a lab like that, you need some institutional support as well. And particularly, you know, the department had actually allowed Ray and me to teach this for a while, right? One of the reasons we actually stopped also with it is that we actually ran short of faculty. The retirement rate in Arizona is high. But not anymore. We rejuvenated quite dramatically. But that causes its own problems, of course. And you can just, as a department, not afford to actually put two faculty on a course like that, right? So you have to really get that working. Funding agencies, NSF, used to love this. I don't know if they still do it, because they didn't continue our grant, actually. But anyway. Let's see, in the faculty, this is a problem. Because of the experiments, I think even more than in a theory course, it's hard if you actually want to exchange faculty and say, well, let's come in, let's have a new faculty come in. That's why we saved money in actually putting this lab together, so that when a new faculty member could come in, there was a good $50,000 ready for somebody to actually do something with. But nobody took us up on our offer in this case. So the plan is next year, it's not going to be taught, but the year after we actually plan to actually teach this again for the first time, but since a while. Okay, so these were just some life experiences of, you know, what we think might work or might not work, and problems you may run into if you actually run a lab like this. Yeah?
So have you followed students who took this lab? We've run it now for quite a few years. You mentioned at the beginning, you started the grade. What happened to the students who took it, either
There are a number of
feedback that it changed their career, or that they were able to apply the techniques. Have you done some follow-up on the students?
Yeah, we've looked at some of the students. So a number of the physics students actually moved into biophysics. One of the first students that I actually got when I got there, I said, "Oh, you should take this course to give you an idea of what's going on." And she stayed when he graduated. You know, and actually is a postdoc in biophysics. An applied math student I know now is an assistant professor working on biological problems. So it pays off in some cases.
Applied math students spend a few years of principal help develop a course,
yeah,
on mathematics for molecular biology students.
So I think a number of students stayed in there. So most of the BME students that actually came in, they already chose BME for, you know, biomedical engineering for a specific reason, and they tend to stay where they are, particularly in math. And the astronomy student actually really made the move to more biological aspects of astrophysics and astronomy. So,
could you say another word about what role the external funding played? Was it seed money?
Yeah, so this was part of an program, and the external funding from NSF pretty much made the lab possible. It made possible the renovation, the purchase of the capital equipment involved. And many students many of the graduate students, the rest of the money in that grant actually went to funding graduate students. So in that sense, it was a training grant. But without the NSF Eiger grant, that lab, you know, we wouldn't have been able to put that together. I mean, right now it doesn't take too much money, right? I mean, it's some things break, but you know, you can always find something and put
but
it.
NSF will never sustain that in the long term.
No, NSF is not going to. NSF, yeah.
So we took
a very broad. So one of the problems we had in renewing this grant, for example, we took a very broad view to the interdisciplinary training, and when we actually wanted to renew, the biggest complaint we got is like, well, this is not focused on a particular problem or anything. Yeah, well, that's a difference in philosophy, I think, of what you should do in courses like that. But yes, it would have continued, and there would be have been some money. You know, we could have put some other experiments, right, and bring in some extra money to, so that you can do some other things. Yes, Morris.
So the extent that you had the physics and applied math students, and to the extent that you were expecting to channel some of these people towards biology, do they have some alternative course where they actually learn some molecular biology techniques, where they actually learn the
A course like that does currently not exist. I mean, there's a standard course in MCB, and some of the students actually have taken that. That's I think, first-year graduate program course that you can take in Arizona. Some students actually have taken undergraduate course. But there is no special course designed to actually take in these students and you know, try to get up to speed. So they have to enroll into an existing course. It does exist. For many students, it's somewhat of a problem to actually fit it in, but some students do it.
Would it be possible to actually make taking some type of course as a prerequisite in this course, and that would allow you to do more biology?
Could. I wonder if... I was wondering if having a prereq like that would actually serve a purpose, or you would actually be chasing away students, and I'm not quite sure. What we hope to do, and particularly when we're going to rerun this course, is involve MCB more. I like to get more molecular cell and biochem students in there because they have that experience. You know, and if you put those students together with physics students, right, they teach each other really quickly how to pipe that. I mean, I think that will solve a lot of practical problems. But there are some issues why MCB was not involved and gets to all kinds of things, right?
So, would setting more prerequisites kind of limit funding possibilities?
Could be. I mean, I never believed in prereqs, but then I grew up in the Dutch system where, you know, you got into a course, you didn't know it, then you just took another course to make sure that you knew the stuff, you know, and you did that yourself. So I don't understand this. I have some problems with prereqs ideas, but for that reason, yes.
Something about how you'd given three lectures, and then by the time you got into the data analysis,
and you've given a
Yep. So I didn't. But I missed. Did you actually switch it around? So you put the
night
into taking the data, and then gave some lectures right at the time when they were dealing with.
No, we made the lecture part a little bit shorter, and then we saved time, and then they're going to run into it, and you can say, well, hey, listen, but we talked a little bit about that, right? And then you actually bring it back.
Right.
So
you distribute
parts of the lecture much more over the course of the lecture.
Let's have a break.
He cannot ask a question.
Just one last question. Sorry. Did you try opening the lab to students who wanted to do independent research?
Oh, yes, I should have mentioned that. This lab is not... We don't teach it at this point, right? That doesn't mean the lab is sitting there. I'm using it in a molecular biophysics course that I'm teaching. Students are getting trained in electrophysiology as well as optical trapping in this instrument. They do independent studies. I get high school students who actually come in to do little things with optical tweezers. So it gets used all the time. So that's not the problem, actually.
Can you actually make it happen? I mean, you actually then need a dedicated technician so things just don't blow up?
There is one technician paid through Applied Math. Right next door there's an Applied Math lab. Where there's also different kinds of experiments, with, and he is kind of the technician for both labs, so he keeps an eye on everything. All we do is we bring these students in and say, "Hey, Bob, here's a face. This student is going to show up, a couple of times or throughout the semester." Exactly, and things like that.
So we'll reconvene in 15 minutes.